Very much, Sergio, and thank you all for being here. Good afternoon, everybody. And I really want to applaud the work of the community health worker section and the different sessions that have been organized. And Lisa Renee, congratulations on doing such a good job. And of course, at the Department of Public Health, we look to Gail Hirsch as our guide in terms of doing thoughtful and appropriate work on community health workers, so thank you. What I thought I would try to do, a little bit different than Richard's presentation, is to hone in on the issue of healthcare reform and to try to look at the experience that we've had in Massachusetts in implementing our own healthcare reform initiative over the last few years through the lens of social justice. And so these are slides that I actually did use in the Saturday Institute, but I'm going to go quicker through some of them and focus on a few that I think really highlight the issues related to social justice. And I'm trying to figure out if I think if I press that. Yes. So just to quickly mention, in Massachusetts, what we've seen over the last few years is that we've, as perhaps a suggestion of what will be seen in the rest of the country if the Affordable Care Act is successfully implemented, as we all hope and will fight for it to be, we went through a period where we reduced our the percentage of people who lacked health insurance from about 7% to less than 3%. Now, this often gets referred to as universal health insurance or near universal health insurance, but from the lens of social justice in particular, this notion of the 3% is very important for us to be thinking of. In Massachusetts, what we really did was we reduced by a bit more than half the percentage of the people who lacked health insurance. So we still have probably 150,000 people lacking in insurance. But there were some indications of success and some indications of additional work that needed to be done. This chart looks at the percentages of people who were uninsured by racial groups, both before and after the implementation of our health care reform initiative. And so you see the numbers fluctuate a little bit, but roughly 8% to 4% in terms of the overall population. And that there were reductions across the board in each of the different racial groups that were looked at in this chart. But what is worth looking at here, and it's worth remembering around the country, is that the percentages of the population that lack health insurance are different based upon race and ethnicity. And that, as you can see in Massachusetts, why we had that, you know, relatively low percentage of 8% uninsured, 19% of the Latino population was uninsured, 13% of the Black population. And so again, we've reduced those. That's good. 19 to 11% for the Latino population is moving in the right direction. It still leaves us higher for the Latino population than we were before the implementation of health care reform, and therefore suggests that in its implementation, I think, across the country, there really needs to be targeted efforts to ensure that the populations that have historically been the least likely to have health insurance have access to the new opportunities that are available, and that when it's not possible through the benefits that have been established, that there have to be other ways of addressing their needs. Just to remind us that Massachusetts is different than the many parts of the country, this chart looks at the percentage of uninsured in Texas and compares that to Massachusetts. But the take-home message in terms of Texas is that almost a quarter of the total population lacks health insurance in Texas. You know, it's a state with a significantly higher population than Massachusetts. And some of the indications of the Latino population in Texas, which suggests that as many as 40% of the Latinos in Texas lacked health insurance. So the impact, again, of the implementation of health care reform obviously will be different depending on what the level of uninsurance is across the country, and different still for the subpopulations, in this case Latino population, who have a higher percentage of the uninsured. You know, just to give some sense of what happens from the perspective of healthcare, this gives you some sense, I'll give you some sense of what we saw in terms of access to seeing a doctor in the past 12 months. This looks at post-healthcare reform in Massachusetts and shows that about 90% of the overall population say that they saw a doctor in the last 12 months. That's a very high percentage, and it's you see it's high across the different age groups. When we compare that, the 97%, approximately 97% of the Massachusetts population with the 3% who still lack health insurance. What we find is the 3%, those with health insurance are about 85% see a doctor during the year. Those without health insurance, it's about half who see a doctor. So having health insurance, particularly for those 3%, is going to have a very significant impact on their access to health care and their overall health. This looks at the same issue in terms of preventive health care. Preventive health care meaning, you know, the services that include flu shots and screening for cancer, et cetera. And here we see in Massachusetts about 3/4 of the insured population have a preventive health visit in the last 12 months. But when we look at those who lack health insurance, it's about a third. So from the perspective of social justice there, we have a significant population who aren't getting core services that we would be considering essential preventive services, particularly from a public health perspective. Just as a reminder of what this has to do with health, the surveys indicate, this is another survey that's the BRFSS survey, that indicate that if you ask people in a long survey, are you insured or non-insured, and then later on you say, are you in good health or poor health, those who are uninsured are much more likely to say they're in poor health, fair or poor health, as contrasted with good or very good health. So this is just one more indication. Money and the availability of resources, so the relationship to socioeconomics and poverty has a great relationship to access to health care. This is the same BRFSS survey where people were asked, did you need health care in the last year, but was cost an obstacle in your being able to get the care? And you can see that in this case, the blue bars represent those who were uninsured. About 2/3 of the people who were uninsured said they needed care in the last year, and finances were an obstacle to their being able to get the care that they needed. So many of them didn't get the care that they needed. Clearly a correlation between poverty and access to care. Just another indication of what happens if you don't get, if you can't afford it, much lower likelihood of seeing a dentist. We did see some indications immediately after healthcare reform that were promising, increased flu shots, colonoscopies, decreased in smoking. I won't go into those so much, but I do want to focus on some aspects of what public health can play an important role, and again, in the implementation of healthcare reform throughout the country, and with, again, thinking about where are the opportunities in that implementation to pay particular attention to the issues of social justice. So I would argue that it's important for public health people who work in municipal organizations as well as public health activists in general to struggle to have a voice in terms of the insurance packages that will be developed state by state. By this I mean what's included in those insurance packages, what benefits are, what benefits aren't, and also what are the financing structures of them? Are there co-pays or the deductibles? How high are those? My own experience is if public health people are not at the table, often these issues, often many of these issues get looked at, get ignored in terms of the concerns that we would have. So a couple of things I would mention here. On that second bullet about chronic disease counseling for diabetics, that's a service sometimes provided by community health workers that for a newly diagnosed person, say with diabetes, where the doctor has 15 minutes with the person, and then the person is told eat well, exercise more, you know, regularly do blood checks, and then they leave. And, you know, disproportionately, if we look at diabetes, in Massachusetts, it's 2.5 times the prevalence of diabetes in the Black and the Latino population. So we have a disproportionate percentage of the population who are low income and don't speak English, and who are given complicated information in a short amount of time without the necessary counseling and support. So determining if you can have culturally and linguistically appropriate counseling, multiple session counseling following a diagnosis of chronic disease, we know that will work in terms of better compliance with medication, reducing symptoms. If it's not built into insurance packages, chances are it won't be funded. Grant funding means a few places will have that, but most places won't. So public health people can be at the table and say, what about that? What will it take to get that as consideration for one of those benefits? This next bullet down is, it focuses on the community health workers themselves. And this is, we know, for example, that the community health workers play a critical role in terms of being able to connect patients who get complicated information to the taking the steps that are necessary to improve their health, both by making sure they understand the information that was presented to them and then helping them to make changes in their own lives and in their communities that will make a difference. Similarly, community health workers work at the community level in terms of focusing on some of the social determinants of health. So my own view is whenever possible, we should be struggling to make sure, where we can, that community health workers are part of the health packages that are being developed for insurance, and that their services are reimbursable as part of the clinical team. The next bullet down, again, I would just raise is related to the issue of social justice, and that is often those people who have substance abuse or mental health diagnoses are often ignored in the provision of health care. And even with the expansion of health care access to people, it's very possible that there will be limited access to substance abuse and mental health services. So this too is something we have to fight for. We have to make sure that we're working to get those services included in the core packages. If we don't, the consequences, I think you all know, would be quite serious. This copay and deductible piece, critically important. We saw, for example, relating again to substance abuse services, that while we had access to health care insurance for many people who didn't have it before, including some of the people who had chronic substance abuse problems, prior to health care reform, a number of them could access detoxification services for free because public health would pay for the beds for the uninsured. Post-healthcare reform, a number of those individuals, many of those individuals, had access to subsidized healthcare packages. That was good. That gave them greater flexibility in getting different kinds of healthcare services. But built into their packages were copays and deductibles for detox. And so what it meant was, for some, they actually had some additional obstacles we had to pay attention to as they would go into a detox facility. They'd have an insurance card, but the detox facility would say, we have a $50 copay. And by the way, the detox facilities are not allowed to waive that. It's prohibited that they waive some for some patients and not for others. So it created this unintentional obstacle to care, some critical care. So really important to pay attention to those details in terms of the implementation of healthcare reform. Measuring the impact of healthcare reform, the health issues I was mentioning all earlier is very important. I'd focus on this issue of filling the gaps. We know, for example, that healthcare reform nationwide is expected to offer health insurance at its full implementation to 32 million additional Americans who don't currently have health insurance, but they're 45 million. Americans who don't have health insurance. So they're always going to be, even at the full implementation, a significant percentage of the population that's going to need services. Public health programs need to make sure we're paying attention to those populations and that we fight for those services so that assumptions made by legislators and other policymakers that we no longer need public health programs that serve the poor because of health insurance won't end up causing people who are currently getting some of these services to lose them. And then there's some specialized services that will continue as well. Some dangers in terms of thinking about this issue of whether healthcare reform will know whether healthcare reform will take the place of public health. This is a danger. There's going to be a lot of pressure on legislators to come up with ways to save money to cover the cost of health care reform, and they don't always ask the follow-up questions. They simply look at what sounds to them like health care under public health, say, let's cut that because we can assume if people have insurance, they won't need that anymore. And there's some real dangers involved in that. You know, one clear one is prevention for the most part, what's called prevention in healthcare reform really refers to clinical preventive services, important services like vaccinations, screening for cancer, but not focusing on primary prevention and not focusing on changing the social determinants of health by creating conditions in people's lives and in their communities that decrease the likelihood that they're going to get sick to begin with. And that's the critical role for public health that we have to work on. And that includes everything from menu labeling to changing foods in the schools to providing parents with information, changing worksite health wellness programs. And we have a particular grant program that is similar to what is being discussed by CDC as community transformation grants, where communities are given grants to change some of the policies in their cities and towns so that the healthier conditions might be the easier conditions that are offered. These include ensuring that schools serve healthy foods to children so parents don't have to wonder, what did my child eat during the day? Was it healthy or not? So that the parks are made safer, that focus on violence prevention as well as making parks accessible with programmatic activities, transportation programs that are prioritized to focus on biking and pedestrian use and not just automobiles. And I won't go into that much more. But here's some of the dangers. And again, from the lens of social justice, if we think that healthcare reform, access to health insurance, will substitute for public health. We found that there were some faulty assumptions about who was covered by what benefits. So one example of that involved family planning in Massachusetts. The legislature, again, thinking now people have health insurance so we can cut public health support of grants to family planning programs, resulted in an unexpected dramatic cut to those programs. As we scrambled to respond to that, we didn't see it coming. We went to the family planning programs themselves and said, who exactly are you serving, and are they going to now be covered by health insurance? Is it okay if these are cut because you have a new source of funding? The family planning agencies presented to us information which showed, number one, a third of the people who use the family planning centers across the state were part of that 125,000 people who had no health insurance. They actually were using family planning centers as a form of primary care to get certain services that they otherwise couldn't get because they knew family planning services were free. An additional approximately a third of the participants in the family planning services were teenagers whose parents often had health insurance, but they were going to family planning because they didn't want their parents to know that they were seeking reproductive health. And if they weren't able to do this, they might not have been able to get it because they would have had to negotiate with their parents and it would have been more of an obstacle. So we were able to make those cases. We got the money restored, fortunately, to family planning. But I would raise those as indications of the potential that we could actually see some unintentional problematic areas that affect very vulnerable populations if we're not really careful about protecting those services where they're needed. Let me see, I think I used that already. Here's just another example where we need to pay particular attention with healthcare reform. Many states, almost all states, run the Women's Health Network, the free breast and cervical cancer screening program for uninsured women. And this is a great program, and it offers a guaranteed annual breast and cervical cancer screening with a lot of support, sometimes with good assistance from community health workers or nurses who call people and remind them to come in. First year of our healthcare reform implementation, we saw a dramatic decrease in terms of the people who were enrolled in the program because as they came in to get their annual breast or cervical cancer screening, they got enrolled in health insurance. And this was great because instead of being uninsured with just two tests once a year, they had comprehensive health insurance. When we went back and looked at what was happening with many of those women 6 months later, what we found was a number of them were no longer getting their annual breast and cervical cancer screenings. And the reason was There were co-pays and deductibles associated with those screenings. And the women were making choices about what's the best use of that $50. Can I afford that? I need that for rent or for food for my family. Maybe I'm not at risk for breast cancer. And partly, I'd like to believe that partly as we fed that information up to our legislators and some of the federal agencies, that contributed to the decision within the Affordable Care Act that those services could never have co-pays and deductibles. So now, as it's being rolled out across the country, we shouldn't see that same kind of an error. But that, I think, illustrates we can solve those problems as we get into the details of healthcare reform if we pay attention to them and mobilize to point out who's getting hurt by if and when that occurs. We in public health need to do a better job, I think, of adapting, making the case that prevention works. One thing that we are paying attention to in both local and state health departments is that a number of our departments in some states actually provide primary care in free clinics that have historically been set up to serve the most vulnerable and neglected populations. Once we get to the point where more and more people have health insurance, there'll be a balance in terms of deciding, do the patients now shift to clinicians who can now get insurance and maybe are more willing to care for those patients, or do municipalities need to retain those services, many of which are very high quality, have been developed to have cultural, linguistic, appropriate services over the years, do the municipal agencies need to adapt those so that they can collect insurance and maximize revenue, or do we transition those over to more of the private sector? A lot of attention needs to be done so we don't close services first and then before there's real opportunities for people to go elsewhere. So another area to pay attention to. Let me just see, I think I'm going to close just by mentioning the latest area that we're working on. We're working now that we've solved some of the access to care, there's a lot of attention on cost. And I think this is inevitable that the focus will shift to the cost of care. Are there ways of bringing down the cost of care? And a lot of attention focuses on the notion of payment reform, that instead of paying for fee-for-service for a particular procedure, you somehow create, instead, a global payment, and you create outcomes that you're going to be paying for, where there are financial incentives for groups of clinicians of different types of agencies to come up with providing high-quality care for a patient that's focused more on care and not just billing for sometimes multiple tests, et cetera. Within that context, we've had in Massachusetts discussions about, is that an arena where we can struggle to have the work of community health workers become reimbursable? It would not be through fee-for-service, so it wouldn't be this notion of on an hourly basis community health worker gets reimbursed a certain fee in the same way that a doctor or a nurse does now. Rather, it would say if there's a global fee that's given for, say, the care of someone with diabetes over the course of the year, and then a group of people, they're often clumped together in what's called accountable care organizations, would strategize about how do we work with that patient to think about the many ways of keeping that patient healthy during the year. We want to encourage those accountable care organizations to think about community health workers as essential members of those teams, working, for example, with the diabetics to make sure that they understand medication compliance so that they know about how to adapt the foods that they traditionally eat to try to reduce calories and fat so that they can think about, given the conditions in their neighborhood, how can they exercise more, and also how can they work to organize so that the conditions in their communities can be more conducive to exercise and having access to healthy foods. That would be a very productive outcome to include a steady stream of revenue if we can include community health workers within those redesigns for payment reform. But that's just the promise. That's the possibility that exists. Again, in terms of public health people, we're the ones who are going to be suggesting that. If public health people don't suggest that as these payment reform efforts go on, that community health workers be considered as a critical part of the solution, chances are they won't be raised at all. So thinking about that, taking advantage of the opportunities we have now to support community health workers as key members in the effort to implement healthcare reform, but to do it in a way that promotes social justice and avoids some of the dangers that historically have existed in the availability of care and the inequity in terms of the burden of disease and premature death. The opportunity's there. The question is, can we take advantage of it? Thanks.
So I just want to take a moment to thank these two gentlemen for their complimentary and mutually supportive perspectives on issues of social justice, equity, and health reform. And we'd like to welcome, to open the floor to your questions. Poetry all the way in the back.
Thank you very much. One of your thoughts of our conversation earlier in the roundtable of the AEW earlier in the COVID-19. And this is about the basic human rights of community health worker, particularly community health worker in Arizona.
Hi, my name is Elena, and I'm part of the Arizona Community Health Workers. Arizona, and part of our conversation earlier was, as most of you know, that our laws and our governor that was elected just recently, very strict and laws that we're having to deal with. So one of the concerns that came up was how do we protect ourselves as community health workers. Say we have to do their home visits or transportation or one-on-one, all these different things that are included in our job. And, you know, when I transport somebody to get a mammogram, I'm not going to ask them for documentation. So that was one of the issues that came up. And
I'm saying that this is, I think, the right forum to bring that because it talks about policy internally. How healthcare workers can be protected. We're talking about social justice and racism, but this is an issue that is very close to our face right now, that healthcare workers who are the frontliners are the first victims if we are not coming up with a policy or a voice from this conference over this particular experiences that I particularly as a CSW, I would be very concerned here as the very first step, and then and the rest of the topic.
So I think it's two things. How do we protect ourselves as CHWs from, you know, avoiding those types of situations and get pulled over or whatever? Who's going to protect us? And then the other thing is also advocating for these people and explaining them their rights, because a lot of questions that I receive have nothing to do with, you know, their health. They want to know, is immigration picking up people at the DES office, the economic service office? And I know the clinic I work at has seen a very big decline, yes, thank you, in the people that we are servicing. And so they're not bringing their children to receive their immunization shots. They're not getting their acne screening because they're scared. Obviously, they're scared, and of course, they trust us, so that's who they come to first to ask and, you know, to receive that reinforcement and that, you know, that's not, it's not going to happen, but I can't really tell them, you know, if that's what's going to happen. And of course, then we have to take care of our own selves also. So that was a big concern that came up earlier.
Well, would, I mean, this is a big issue, and I think it speaks to Richard's perspective that there is a power differential and that these are the core issues that we really need to be addressing. Who elected this woman and, you know, and who voted and who didn't vote? And that's the political power is the tool of oppression in many cases. And it's not rooted in this particular policy. The root cause is that, you know, we're not exercising power. I would say, just as an organizer of CHWs and a leader in my region of the country, that our network does exercise the power and political will to address these issues on a large scale like that. And I know ASCHOW is also very robust and vibrant in political issues. And it's even more important reason why we have to continue to organize both nationally and locally as CHWs to bring that power to bear in supporting our communities.
Yes, please.
My perspective on this is that there's both short-term and long-term responses to that. The longer-term ones, I think, have to do with the larger social issues and elections and working to change policies. I just share with you what my experience was like in several years ago when there were similar proposals in Massachusetts and some benefits were for citizens only. And truthfully, I think that what happened that was that the employers of the healthcare the community health workers have to be responsible for protecting the community health workers. That's my view. That it can't be viewed as the responsibility of the community health worker to address this issue. It's really got to be the employers, and they have to. In Massachusetts, what we saw, many of them worked for community health centers, and the community health centers, you know, got together and had legal advice, and fortunately were able to find legal advice that was free and willing to be protective. There was a real serious effort to document everything that was happening so that information was collected in a systematic way, that there was easy access to protection if it was needed, legal protection, so that, again, it wasn't up to a single healthcare worker. There was a system in place that had been developed to be supportive. So I think that's a really local response. I think that really means that communities need to figure out the short-term solution, right? It's not the long-term solution. That's the short-term solution, just to mean that if you're going to go out next week or 2 weeks from now, you have some degree of protection and assurance that you know what to say to your client and you know that you know about your own safety and your client's safety. So.
Thank you, John. Right here.
Not a better way.
Well, thanks. First of all, I agree with everything you said. And so part of the challenge has been figuring out how do you do it. And what I've come to think of is that there are three different arenas that are where we have to be thinking about this. There's the getting to the table with the insurers. A lot of that is insurance talk, and it's actuarial tables, and it's their rules. It's not our rules. So I could say any of the things that I think are the right thing to say, but it's their agenda, and you know they make those decisions. So with those, when I get to those tables, then I've got to speak in their language, which is short-term return on investment, pay for this, you get that, or else they're, you know, I've tried other things, and they basically, you know, don't want me to come back or don't pay any attention to what I have to say. The second arena is the community-based one, and that I didn't talk about that, but I should have, that within the Affordable Care Act, within Healthcare Reform Act, there is this whole prevention and public health trust funding that it should be channeling money into communities and into health departments to build the infrastructure to really focus on prevention. And that should money, if we don't lose it, ideally should be going to creating some of the conditions that are really going to have an impact on people's lives, if it's done well and if it's, you know, there's enough resources there. The third area is the one that I get a little kind of nervous about, and that's the one right in the middle. And that's these services that are really not population-based or population-specific, and they're not really exclusively considered to be clinical services. They're these ones that really make a difference in people's lives, like, and community health workers right up there, but it's also things like meaningful chronic disease self-management, training people to take control of their own lives, community organizing that gets all of the Latina diabetics to come together to think about how they can bring the farmer's market or work on another issue in their community. That section, I'm not sure who's going to pay for that, and because I'm not sure it'll be paid for by those grants I was referring to, and I'm not sure it'll be paid for by reimbursement, but somebody's got to pay for it. And I've talked some to Elise and Renee about this, is that I think that we really need to think, public health, state and local, need to think together with the community health worker network about how are we going to make that case, that that middle piece that transcends the sort of connecting to what's happening in the workplace to what's happening in people's lives and having the biggest impact needs to be there along with the other two pieces. So.
If I could just add to that, John, a couple of years ago when Dr. Paul Farmer gave the opening speech at this convention, he was very eloquent about the use of experimental design to evaluate human interventions and how inappropriate it really was, and how the fact that public health has so invested in this methodology as a gold standard for supporting programs has really done significant harm, and it's time to move on to other ways of evaluating programs and financing them. It was a large speech, of course, and some of that rhetoric got lost in the volume of the speech. But that's an important consideration, because people's lives are not experimental designs. And this evidence base that we've built based on experimental design, with randomized controlled trials being the gold standard, is really not relevant to human existence. You can't control experimentally for factors in people's lives the way these studies do. And so those results are really coming to be understood as irrelevant to public health interventions, and are really starting to help to redefine public health. Leaders like Commissioner Auerbach, and in my state, the dean of the Columbia University School of Public Health, the Mailman School of Public Health, has really undertaken efforts to recapture the authority of public health, because public health's authority really came from our vision and from our mission. And at some point in history, when we surrendered that authority to medicine, we lost a lot of our power and a lot of our authority. And so nationally, there is, with eloquent leaders like these, there is a move to recapture that authority and that power. Yes, John.
Have we noticed that public health is more so than other entities on the defensive when it comes to having to prove things. The people who are doing harm in public health, to the public's health, such as, developers maybe in some cases, nobody asked them to provide data. Nobody asked them to do the health impact assessment of social policy, but we always have to prove, you know, for the resources that we need. I just think it's an interesting, ironic situation.
I'm actually at Brigham and Women's Hospital and looking at the effects of health reform on low-income women. And so sort of the pre-influenced health reform, and have done a little bit of work with BRSS also. And one of the interesting things that I saw looking at the data specifically against women is that there's an upward trend in affordability issues, so inability to see a doctor due to cost, for the middle-income group. So where for both high and low-income groups, you see a decrease. The trend is downward. And again, low-income groups still have a higher rate of affordability issues than the middle-income group, but the trend for the middle-income group is up. And I think that as we think about policies, it's important to recognize that there's new groups that may become vulnerable, and it's likely because low-income groups are more able to access subsidies and other resources that people within the middle group just don't have access to. And I just think that's an interesting thing in the conversation and figure out how we can target those groups to have the trend stay in the right direction.
Thank you for that comment. There are a lot of hands in the back. We've got 5 minutes, and I'll try to get to you. 1, 2, 3. Yes, yes, Maria.
I just wanted to add to the comment, the first question, which was about financing, and to start to forget the other piece of the community health workers, which is the Promotora community piece, that in this whole financing, because they are using stipend or their volunteers, that there be a mechanism that allows organizations to be able to funnel those funds to them. We're discussing in California a pooling process where the money can be pooled and then a clinic or whoever can use it, similar to what you mentioned, can use it in whichever way. Otherwise, if we're going to see the Promotora, the volunteer communities diminish over time, and what you'll have is more paid staff, which is fine, but there has to be a combination. That's what we've seen over time. So I just want that, that consideration as this whole piece is developed.
That's a great model, I think, to think about as a possibility, that the trust, this notion of creating a trust, maybe through a portion of what's collected from reimbursement, and then channeling that out to the community.
Sure. I give that to you.
Thank you.
Can I just take this one last?
Preventive visit is much more a good indicator, a surrogate marker for primary care, I think.
Thank you. Well, I actually have a question for each of you. So for Commissioner Auerbach, the question is, how do we get to the table with the insurance companies? Like, you can do it more easily than we can. And so I'm interested if you have any suggestions for people with like an MPH or the community health workers in the room. And then, my other question is, scientific reductionism is a big part of what was ringing in my head when you were speaking, and I'm really interested in getting generalists into the room with policymakers, because a part of the problem is there's all these expert subject matter specialists making decisions and not thinking about the health impact of the policies that they're making. So I'm wondering what you think we can do about that politically.
The Division of Labor. So I think you asked me the first one and Richard the second one. So each state is different in because each state is convening these groups that are looking at the ways of developing insurance options. And it's still at an early stage, but in a number of communities there are going to be advisory groups that are established, or there may be, if not advisory groups, public comment periods. And so I think it's really important to think about, to investigate those and to find out where the possibilities are. In the event that they're advisory groups, then I think I'd mount a campaign, you know, through the governor's office or whoever's doing the appointing, to have a representative on there who can put forward the perspective of perhaps a community health worker or the public health community. But it does require sort of being ready for that opportunity, having a candidate ready that the larger community might say, here's our spokesperson. And in some of these cases, just in terms of if it's talking about the shaping those insurance packages and really talking benefit packages, it does mean learning their language. It's like you have to be bilingual, bicultural with insurers. You know, they speak like this whole other language, and unless we can speak their language, they don't pay attention to us. And we can sometimes translate what we want to say into language that they can understand, but we have to know how to do that because they dismiss things that are not put in terms that they are familiar with. So I think it's sort of preparing by thinking about where's the strongest arguments that maybe has that return on investment kind of lingo attached to them would be another way of handling that, I think.
If I understood your question, I think it's important to have community residents and what we call, you know, affected populations in these conversations. I think communities know, and people live in communities know an awful lot. They may not know it or put it in a certain kind of scientific terminology, but they have a great deal of knowledge, and I think that needs to be respected and, you know, become part of the conversation in terms of determining what I was saying earlier about, you know, whose research questions and so forth. There's an interesting book by a fellow named Jason Corburn called Street Science that talks a lot about popular epidemiology and the role of community residents in determining their futures and being involved in these kinds of decisions.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. And I just want to add very quickly, we've had great success in New York in bringing the insurers to the table, specifically by using targeted, very concise messages that they understand. They don't care about the warm and fuzzy, you're going to make people live better lives. They literally want to hear, I can save 27% of your Medicaid budget.
Right.
That's what they, very short, quick, bulleted points, and then they show me how. We've actually developed a collaborative up in northern New York where the four major insurance companies in the county are going to pool money now so that small medical practices can hire CHWs, and so that pool can hire CHWs and the small medical practices in the region can utilize CHWs to serve the entire county. So they're very interested in these business models. They're paying the bills, and they're losing big bucks. So you talk to them about saving money, they're at the table. Lisa Renee, you want a closing comment? Yeah, thank you very much, Lisa Renee. So I want to once again thank our distinguished speakers for their presence and contributions to this conference. It has been an enormous and very unique one. Thank you very much.